Welcome to episode 12 of Unwrapped, the human behind the profile. In this episode, Donna shares her incredible story, from losing her baby brother when he was just 3 months old, and its resulting impact on her entire family. Suffering for 4 decades with poor mental health, her decision to not have children, and the realisation that she has ultimate control of her journey, and taking steps to live a life that gives her an overall sense of happiness. So, here we go, over to you, Miranda.
Welcome, Donna, and I'm thrilled to have you on this episode of Unwrapped.
Good to be here.
So I guess I'd like to start with kind of a big question, really, which is who is Donna?
Straight in. Who is Donna? Donna is a loud Brummer who stands up for who she is. And is learning not to make apologies for being that person. I am a lover of learning. I think learning is a superpower. And I am living my life to support others to unlock their own superpowers along the way. I come from a really down-to-earth working class background. I have 2 amazing younger sisters. Being a big sister was the first and is still probably the most important role in my life. Mm-hmm. I've had quite a squiggly career, but that's, I guess that's been punctuated by me not being afraid to poke the bear. That's kind of, I think that's probably been the biggest defining thing in my career, in my choices. I've experienced mental health issues throughout my adult life. I had my first breakdown at 18, 19. And subsequently, what am I now, mid-40s, there've been 4 of those. So that's definitely played a part. I think those are probably the big things. Those are probably the biggest things that have shaped who I am sitting here in front of you today.
So, I mean, first of all, there's loads to like unpack there. And, you know, thank you for sharing. So let's go back. And let's talk about, so you reference being a big sister, and I love that. It's like, and you still see in your mid-40s your role as a big sister. Talk to me a bit about that first.
So I am one of 4 children, actually. The oldest, first to arrive, arrived outside of wedlock, which was not the done thing. And I suppose all of that shapes, doesn't it? All of that plays a part. So it meant that in my earliest formative years, lived with my grandparents. Spending time with both my mum's and my dad's parents, that being a really big influence on my life. I was at the wedding. I've often heard stories of how every time the vicar asked my dad a question, I screamed, not sure what I was trying to get across there, but I let everybody know that I was there. And it's really weird looking at those photos and seeing little old me at the front. After marrying, moving into their first little flat, my mum and dad had their second child. That was my brother Warren, and actually he died at 3 months of cot death. And died on my dad's birthday. To lose a child in itself is just a tragedy I don't think you can comprehend. But for that to happen on a birthday, I mean, that's just a whole other level, isn't it? It did mean that they went on to have my amazing, beautiful sisters. So Michelle and Vicky. Yeah, and so we're a three, and it's interesting when there's three, isn't there? Because there's always one left out. They're really close in age. They're only 18 months apart. And so always they shared a room. They were in school together. I was leaving school as my youngest sister was starting school. So we were kind of bookended at those 5 years. But yeah, really different characters. We have so many similarities and so many differences that you know we're family, but we are also so different in so many ways. And being the oldest makes you, I think there's certainly when in the age that we were growing up, you would as the oldest, while your parents were out at work and both had to go out to work. So you would get home from school and you would be the responsible person, you know. Would make sure that they were okay. And some of the arguments that we had, I smile to myself because I'm remembering. I remember having a proper row with my middle sister Michelle, she's always known how to push buttons. Michelle, she's effective at that. And we had our front door was one of these with a wooden frame with big glass panels in it. And I remember pushing her. She really wound me up and I pushed her. And in that split second, saw her head going towards the glass front door and immediately grabbed her to rescue her. Like, oh, my God, are you OK? that flip of emotion from through to, oh, my God, I've got to save your life. Like,
I want to kill you. Now I want to save you.
I want to kill you, but I've got to save you. You're my little sister. Yeah. And that comes first. We had some adventures in those hours after school between arriving home and parents getting home. I remember we borrowed a suit. We were going on holiday and we borrowed a massive suitcase from my grandparents, and we were curious as to how big it actually was. So we got my youngest sister Vicky to climb in the suitcase, and then thought it was hilarious to zip it up and stand it up and watch her wiggle as it fell over, and just laughing till our bellies hurt, our cheeks hurt, tears coming down our faces. I mean, probably I say that I'm a caring big sister. I don't know how caring that was, but it was hilarious. Like, we found amusement in those things. It matters, doesn't it? They still come to me for updating CVs. My little sister last year, oh, I don't know, I've got my annual performance review and I'm looking to ask for a pay rise. Can you help write this? Like, I know what I want, but I don't know how to say it. You're better at this sort of stuff. So I'm still like the letter writer, the complaint maker, the cheerleader. Like, that's never changed. I'll always be their biggest supporter. I'll always have their back.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because I feel in much of what you said really resonates. So I'm a big sister as well. So I have two brothers and they're only 14 months apart. So there's but there were different times. So I was the peacemaker. So if they were fighting, it was for me to get in between. And I think you're right. You're almost like the next parent. So even though there's not a huge age gap between us, when there is a younger sibling, you're almost automatically elevated to a sort of position of more caregiver and helper for mum and dad. So that really resonates. And they slept together. And I remember being incredibly jealous at points because when we, you know, back in the 70s, we'd get sent to bed. And they had each other and could chat. And then there was me, who actually, looking back, was going very lucky, had my own space and my own room, but focused on the fact that I was missing out on whatever was going on in their room. And it felt like they had a, you know, that bit of a connection in a sense that I didn't, in those moments, I didn't feel part of. It's interesting, isn't it?
It is. And I think there's something in that that's definitely stayed with me throughout life. So not in a resentful way, but more a sense of awareness. So absolutely, you know, as a youngster, the fact that they'd be giggling and they'd have each other to share those things with, and sometimes feeling a little bit left out of that. And sometimes, you know, not wanting that additional responsibility. Like, you don't make that choice, do you? You don't make the choice to be born first. No. You make the choice that there are siblings to come after you. And so I think when you're young, when you're figuring out your own way in the world, you go through a real roller coaster of kind of pushing some of that responsibility away. But as we've got older, so I made the choice very, very early on that I wouldn't have children, and both of my sisters absolutely wanted to be mums. My youngest sister Vicky, she used to baffle me. She used to say, when you'd say to her, what do you want to be when you grow up, like what do you want the future to look like, I want to be a mum. I want to be a secretary and I want to be a mum. And I would go, that blows my mind, like, don't you want more for life? And just, what more is that, like that? And so those real differing perspectives, I think in part actually come from those early experiences, that family order. Certainly some of the stuff around my brother, I think, definitely shaped that. But so even now, they both have three children. They live really close to each other. They used to live literally round the corner from each other. How beautiful for the kids to always each other in that sense. But there are moments now where I look and it's like, I love that they have that with each other, for each other. But it's very different. It's very different to my own life, my own trajectory. Never ever changes the fact that I will always be there. But it's different, isn't it? And there are certainly in those moments where I've struggled with poor mental health, with illness, some of those thoughts and feelings come up and you question, or I've questioned the choices that I've made, how I'm perceived because of those choices, where that means I fit. What that means for I think for any parent, becoming a grandparent is like the pinnacle, isn't it? From what I've stood back and observed, when a parent becomes a grandparent, the whole world shifts, and it's this magical moment of all the fun without the responsibility. So definitely those moments of seeing, wondering if that's changed my relationship with my parents, being the one not to have children. And it does, doesn't it? It very naturally does. Good, bad, neither. It's not. It's just different.
Yeah.
It's just different.
Yeah. I think it's interesting because I think you're right. But I also think that there's the acceptance around, no, the relationship means the relationship is different, but it's not better or worse. It's just different. And there's, you know, it's one of those things, you asked your parents kind of how do they see those relationships. I'm sure they don't, in most cases people won't see them as, well, that one's better than that one, because it would just be that there's a different dynamic in those relationships, but each has very much their merits. So it's interesting to me because I was never maternal, but I just kind of assumed, I was never one of those that, like, you know, not certainly not like your sister, that was like, I want to be a mum. So they're up for you know, for many women that's a longing, an absolute, you know, they have a clarity early that's absolutely is a core part of them, you know, fulfilling their sort of life and their aspiration. It was never like that for me, but weirdly I just kind of assumed I'd have kids. So it was just like, Yeah, I will. And I, to this day, I don't know. I didn't feel obligated to. So it definitely wasn't, oh, well, I suppose I should. I just always assumed I would. But it was never sort of this innate drive to have. And then for some people, so you said you had a clarity early that you didn't want kids. How early was that and how clear was it? And did that ever waver for you?
Yeah, so it's one of the things I find really interesting throughout life, and particularly hitting perimenopause. So that is there have been two points where I have wavered or questioned my choices. One was when I got married. My husband is pretty damn amazing man, and made me see myself in a really different light. He was the first person ever in my life to make me wonder whether actually that might be a choice to me. And then perimenopause, there is something about your body letting you know that that isn't an option that makes you go, fuck.
Yeah.
Oh, like, now that choice isn't necessarily mine, if that makes sense. Now that choice is like, nature's taking its course, nature's doing its thing, this is how life works. But now I'm going, oh, is that okay? Do I feel okay with that? Which has been really weird. That's been a bit of a head fuck, I've got to be honest.
I think it's that makes absolute sense, because there's something that says for a long time, we, you know, as women, we often we don't know our levels of fertility, you know, even when we're young, right? But there's largely, most young people assume if they want to, they'll be able to have kids. And I think there's definitely more of a consciousness around infertility now than there certainly was when I was growing up. And so I don't remember ever having conversations with any friends that would include the kind of, what if I can't, right? I think it was a bit of a conversation for me, because I'm adopted. And so whilst it wasn't because of my parents' infertility, I know that some families become families through other avenues, right? So there's maybe a slightly higher level of awareness around those things. But it never dawned on me that I wouldn't be able to. And it was only with friends that latterly struggled with fertility. And I also think, as human beings, there's something that says, you know, you would have had a long period where it'd be, well, if I do change my mind, it's cool. And then, as you say, perimenopause starts to say, actually, either you've got a very now short window to make a decision, and it might not be straightforward, or it might be saying you've missed the boat. And it feels like that would make sense, that would then have you in a moment where you're going, oh, have I made the right decision? Because there's a finality to that point, isn't there?
There is. I also think there's definitely something in my makeup that's tell me I can't and I'll show you I can. Am I about to make you spit tea at your computer? Yeah. That whole, like, something has taken that choice away from me, and that makes me want to stand up and fight.
Yeah.
And I can look back on several key moments in my life and know that's exactly what was at play. Tell me I can't and I'll show you I can. Quite simple.
It is. It's true. You know, when we want what we can't have, right? So we could have had it and we didn't want it, but at the point we can't have it, we want it, not because we want it, but because we don't want to be told we can't have it. You know, it's like you know, I mean, I always think about even in work situations, you know, if you don't have an opportunity to do something, you might not even have wanted to, but the fact you didn't have the opportunity, I know for me, will make me furious. You know, it's like, you know, even with clients, if we, you know, if you don't win a piece of work in the sales process, we might be going, yeah, not sure this is for us. But if the client makes a decision that actually it's a no, I have a massive reaction to that. And then somebody say to me, but you said you didn't think it was for us anyway. And I'm going, that's not the point.
That's not the point. I had when I first took the leap to go self-employed, I applied for a piece of associate work and I did the first stage of the interview. And I came out of it and I said to my husband, wasn't great. And I'm just not sure that it's a good fit. There's just something in me that doesn't feel right. I can't quite put my finger on what it is. And I got invited back for a second interview. I was like, oh, well, okay, let's go. Let's see how this goes. Let's see how it plays out. Nothing to lose. And so did the second interview. And again, came out of it. And my husband said, how did it go? How was it? How'd you feel? I'm just not sure. Really not sure. I just don't know that we're a good fit. Yeah. And no good, no bad, no tangible, this isn't me, this doesn't work. It just didn't gel. And then I got the email saying we're not taking this any further. And I was like, rude. That was my decision to make. How dare you take that away from me?
Yeah.
And I knew all along I didn't feel sure about it. But the second that decision was made, I was like,
Yeah. Excuse me.
Yeah, just a moment there. Hold on.
So I'd like you to talk a bit more. You said right at the beginning that you've always had this propensity, ability to poke the bear. So when did that first show itself?
So one of the things for me growing up, I had quite a challenging relationship with my dad. And there's something beautiful, isn't there, about getting older, being able to take a step back and see a very different perspective on things. What I am able to see now that I perhaps didn't value during those formative years was that he taught me to stand up for myself. He taught me to stand my ground, to not be taken advantage of, to not go with the whims of others, to to know my value, to know my worth, and to stand tall in that.
Yeah.
So going into the world of work, I feel like everything in life is across a spectrum, isn't it? There's polarity and duality in all of it. We very often operate with conflicting ideas and principles. So on the one hand, I've got this really strong work ethic. That working class background that you work hard, you make your own success, you make your own path. With this whole, I remember being early teenagers, I think it would have been, and my nan saying to me, come on, Donnie, you need to learn to butter the bread properly because that might be your job. You might make sandwiches. That might be what you do. And I went, that will not be what I do. I was absolutely like disgusted that she thought that was the extent that I was going to achieve in life. Like, and no disrespect, like all jobs have their merit. And it's not about judging the value of a job somebody does or judging the person based on the job that they do. But I felt so strongly that I was destined to do so much more in the world than simply make sandwiches. That didn't float my boat. And again, this idea that somebody was putting a ceiling on what I was going to be able to go out in the world and duh. And I'm sure that wasn't her intention. Like, I'm sure that's not where it came from. It was a really innocent comment. But I kind of knew at that point that I wasn't very good at being told that's the path you're going to take. That's what you're going to do. And so one of my first jobs was in a well-known sports retailer that doesn't actually exist anymore. I lasted 2 weeks. So I was like 17 at sixth form, doing a bit of part-time work in the post office where I'd done my work experience. And then I got this job for this sports retailer. And on the first week, I did my interview, got the job, and then turned up. It was £16 for the day. So we'd be in at like 7:30 in the morning. We'd finish once everything was tidy at like 7:30 at night. They wanted me to buy my uniform. This emblazoned tracksuit that I couldn't wear anywhere else other than work. And they wanted to use some of my hard-earned £16 to pay for this tracksuit. I was like, I'm not entirely sure how I feel about this. I've got a bit. And then week two, so I did my first day and I went back the following week. And that second week, it was, Donna, off you pop. You're going to be responsible for keeping the toilets clean today.
Oh, wow.
No, I'm not. Yeah. Like, I'm drawing a line here. I don't feel that's where I want to spend my day. And so off I popped. See you later. We'll move on to something different. And throughout, so all of the jobs that I've done, it's reaching that point where I've never been afraid to challenge authority. I've never been afraid to say, I don't agree. I don't think that's right. That doesn't always go down well, does it?
No.
And that thing of you work hard. I've always worked really hard to learn whatever I do and to do it well. It matters to me to do a good job. It matters to me to be good at what I do. And so when I worked in retail, really quickly, I fell into being like a troubleshooter. I'd be sent all around the country into problem stores.
Yeah.
To sort out what was going on. And I found through doing that, that what I really loved was developing people.
Yeah.
I could go in and I could be the badass and I could, you know, tell them what was wrong and what needed sorting. I could be really firm and really directive about that. But what I loved was nurturing the people on the side, that knowing I was there for a finite amount of time, they would be able to keep those changes going.
Yeah.
And so found myself sort of saying, like, I found my spark. I found where I want to be. I found what I want to do. How do I make this happen? But no, Donna. Your place is here. Your place is in this box. But I don't want to be in that box.
Yeah.
But that's your place. Yeah. That's where you belong. Oh, no. No. Well, let's have a word about this, shall we?
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, the start in our careers was very similar. So I too worked in retail and found myself troubleshooting. And so I think I look back, and that's 30 years ago. And I look back and go, actually, nothing's changed, in the sense that I still know that I feel my best in those sort of situations. What I don't do well with is BAU. So, you know, the business as usual, when things are sorted, when things are just good and ticking along.
Boring.
Exactly. Then I kind of go, it's almost like thriving in environments where you don't know what you're going to get. But I think also the payoff is enormous. You know, if you go into, whether it's a store or you're working with a team, you know, current day, and there is opportunity to do better, be better, and you're able to facilitate that, be part of that process. I think, you know, I'd look at whether it's the, you know, each Friday and looking back and being able to pinpoint the dip, it's such a cliche, but being able to pinpoint having been able to make a difference, which isn't, you know, if you join a business and you you inherit a high performing team, then you can have a very good existence, right? Greater chance of work life balance, because if everybody's doing what they need to be doing in the best way possible, managing that can be fairly straightforward outside of external influences. But yeah, you know, it doesn't take long before you're like, it's just, yeah, it's hard to get up for that. Does that make sense?
It does. I think really early on, one of the values that became super important to me was learning. Learning was this magical key that meant anything was possible.
Mm-hmm.
So I quite enjoyed school. I enjoyed learning. I was that annoying person at the back of the class that would pull up the teacher's spelling mistake on the board. Yeah. But like that voice was there really early. But the ability to learn and knowing that, and again, I think this came from my parents. Donna, put the effort in now. That determines what you can do in the future. And it has really stayed with me. So when I'm in an environment where there's nothing to learn, it's stale.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not learning, I'm not growing, I'm not developing. That means I'm not at my best.
Yeah.
That means I'm not living in my happy place. And there's a lot to be said for work-life balance. Having experienced burnout, it's really, really fucking important.
Yeah.
What that looks like for each person is different.
And 100%. For me,
it is crucial that in whatever I'm doing, there is enough variety to keep my interest. But yeah, that within that, it's not variety for variety's sake. There has to be the opportunity to learn. And as soon as that stops, it's like hitting a brick wall. It's like getting up to hit my head on a brick wall each morning. Yeah. Why would you do that?
Yeah. It's one of my favourite sayings, and I don't know if I've got it absolutely spot on, but essentially, if you're the smartest person in the room, you're in the wrong room.
For sure.
And there's something about sort of, you know, surrounding yourself with people that you can learn from and, you know, going every day. And I feel very fortunate, you know, I work with a group of people. I learn something from, you know, each of them in almost every interaction. And that's really important. That totally, totally resonates. So you touched on your dad and said around, you know, that you had a difficult relationship, but you now can look back and say, actually, what he did in some respects, whether knowingly or otherwise, set you up for success to sort of challenge the world and go after what you want and all of those things, which is great. How did that sort of manifest itself when you were younger? So without the context of work, how did that sort of show up?
We just didn't get each other. Throughout those formative years, we just didn't get each other. I mean, he'd become a dad unplanned. I think there's something in that. He'd lost a child. I mean, that's huge. And then a family of three young girls and his wife, only man in the house. And I'm, as the oldest, you're kind of the test bed, aren't you? Like, parenting doesn't come with a manual. And whilst I might not have experienced it for myself, I do appreciate the challenge of being responsible for another human being's life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think my dad holds himself to pretty high standards. I think that's something I can see now. He holds himself to pretty high standards, and so if ever there was a, if ever it wasn't going right, like that, how that plays out for somebody, how that projects onto that relationship, Commentary challenge. So I, at 18, I had a curfew of like 10, 10:30. 18, I'm technically an adult. What on earth? You live under my house, you live under my rules. And so on the one hand, yeah, I respect that. On the other hand, like, what? I'm an adult, I can vote. What on earth? So things around rules that he would set. I remember being a teenager and wearing makeup to school, and he really didn't approve of that. And I got home one day and he'd gone and cleared my room and thrown out all of the makeup that I had. Like, I told you not to wear it for school. You didn't listen. It's gone. Yes. And he had a very all or nothing approach. Mm-hmm. What then made that really challenging, and where I think I can retrospectively see the learning, was that he was nowhere near as harsh with my sisters. And so all of a sudden you're going, this isn't fair. This isn't right. Like, you can't hold me to one standard and it be really different within the same family group.
Yeah.
So that I found that really, really difficult. But as I say, looking back, I imagine it's that whole thing of he was learning as much through me as I was learning through him, and learning and seeing, and my mum being that buffer zone, being that piggy in the middle. Like, if I wanted to do something, mum, can you ask dad about that? And if she said no, you need to talk to your dad. No, I won't bother. I'll just not do it. That's fine. So kind of going through that and then seeing that ease up, seeing that change, and not being able to appreciate at the time that I was a part of that learning, and it was good that learning was taking place, actually feeling really hurt, really resentful, really, really like typical teenager, I suppose, isn't it? We rebel against the constructs and the confines that are put in place to keep us safe. And I always appreciated it was to keep me safe. I always appreciated that it came from the best place.
Did you, though, at the time?
Well, probably not. I can say that now, can't I? Hindsight's 2020 vision, isn't it?
100%.
Yeah.
Because I grew up in a... my dad was a real disciplinarian. And so there was no, and actually, what I did appreciate even at the time was the clarity, right? So my dad always, he did what if he said he was going to do something, he did it. So I always knew exactly where it was. And I always appreciated that. But obviously what went with that was if he said no, there was no persuading him. So there were times where that decisiveness and then commitment to a course of action, if it didn't go my way, then obviously I didn't appreciate it as much. But I also think it's where it was one of the sort of things that sort of almost instigated the rebellion, right? Because it's, I think, if you're set very firm boundaries that, you know, and it would have been contextual, but at the time I disagreed, because it might be that I want to go to a party and he said no. So as you say, hindsight's 2020, and then I have kids and I'm going, yeah, you're not going to a party till 2 o'clock in the morning, you're 16, that's a no. But at the time, just going, you're preventing me doing what I want to do. And so it was always, I would always challenge those boundaries, and whether that was try and argue, which was absolutely pointless, or climb out the window or go out earlier and not come back and just accept the wrath that I would receive, but I went to the party. Something about challenging boundaries then was my go-to. So I was never accepting, but that was established as a child. But I wonder whether, I mean, my parents would say I was always feisty, but I wonder whether I would have been as challenging had I not been set boundaries. Yeah. I just don't, you just don't know.
You don't know, do you? Because it plays out as it does. But hearing you say that, yes, that makes so much sense. Why do I struggle with authority? Because it was so firm, and actually I didn't agree. And and the contradictions within that. So on this, I used to do loads of amateur dramatics as a kid. Like when I was when I was younger, I used to say, I'm not a wannabe, I'm a gonna be, an actress. And my mum and dad, like, they had nothing. There were times where we lived on a big stew pot of baked bean hot pot for 4 days because it was a cheap meal and that was all they could afford on the shopping that week. And yet they would run me to opposite ends of the country to go and take part in workshops and auditions. And so, yeah, on the one hand, there were really firm rules that I wanted to rebel against, that I didn't understand. On the other, in certain remits, he would go so far the extra mile to facilitate that happening, that actually some of that confusion, why is this okay and this isn't, like, again, it could, not fair. Like, I hear myself with that real childish voice, that's not fair. That's a lot of kind of trying to work out where I stood on things, like what part does fairness play? Is life fair? Is life even fair? Like, the sooner you learn that lesson, the less pain you will put yourself through.
And fairness is a really subjective thing, right? Because every time there's a decision that, for example, doesn't go your way or my way, we see that as unfair. But that decision then probably played out well for somebody else, they would see that as fair.
Yeah.
You know, and so in most situations, you know, for it to play out for one person, often it means it doesn't play out for another. So it's things feel unfair, I think, simplistically, when they don't go as we would have them, right?
Yeah.
So I'm interested in, you talked about your journey in terms of mental health, and actually you talked about there being sort of four episodes. Can you talk to me a bit more about sort of where that started and how that then played out later in life?
So my first episode, I dropped out of university 6 months before completing my degree. I just felt like I felt this overwhelming darkness, this pain within that no matter what, I couldn't get rid of. I couldn't, and I didn't know how to face it. And so went to the doctors, went on medication, went through the process of trying different antidepressants to find something that agreed with me. You know, that journey, I think most people that experience that and go through the GP go through. I remember coming out of the doctors, I remember my dad picking me up. And I'd read a leaflet in the waiting room about manic depression, and saying there's some of this that I really relate to, there's some of this that I really recognise. No, you don't, you'll be fine, sort yourself out. Again, that lack of understanding, that fear, I think, more than anything. Dropped out of uni. Didn't know what that would mean for where I would go or what I would do. And there'd been a process to get to that. I think for all of my episodes, at the time, you don't necessarily see it. But again, once you're able to step back from it with some clarity, you can see that I can see sort of my process for getting there. And I'd secured a place at Lancaster University to do drama. Really excited. That was like my life's ambition. Had decided not to go because of the boy I was in love with at the time. Like one of those really stupid decisions that you make at 18. Had gone through clearing, took a place at a uni in Birmingham doing English because I found that easy, not because I had any particular passion for it. And so I'd spent a couple of years in this space of not really doing the things that in my heart I knew I wanted to be doing. And I guess that plays out, doesn't it? If you try and cram yourself into the box that you think you're supposed to fit in, but you don't, eventually something will give.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I guess what I realise now is that that's how my body, my mind, let me know that I'd crammed myself into a place that wasn't where I truly knew I wanted, I could.
Yeah.
And a pause on the word in language is fascinating, isn't it? Like the word, I'm not a big fan of should, could. Things are as they are. We make the best choices we can with what we've got and what we know. When you know better, you do better. All of those things. But yeah, so that was my first. My second was burnout. I worked in retail. I'd taken on a problem store, turned it around, like had some phenomenal success. Got to go to the Elf Style Awards because I'd been recognised as one of the top performing store managers across the whole of the UK. But got into that place of there were other opportunities, and I turned down a particular opportunity. And I remember the conversation. I said to my area HR, no, the store still needs me. There's stuff there that I still need to do.
Yeah.
Like, over the next year, that played out in a really bad way. I worked sort of like 23-day stints without a day off. I was going in at 5 in the morning, leaving at 1 o'clock the next morning, like really running myself into the ground until my body went, no more. And that took quite a period of recovery. From there, I then moved into the charity sector, which was amazing. I got to work with so many people from so many walks of life that taught me so much about stepping back and seeing other perspectives, seeing other life experiences and all of the learning that comes from that. But my third happened the year I got married. And it was the same year as a significant birthday for my brother. And there was a lot of that playing in my mind. I was taking my bridesmaids' dresses over to my sister's for them to try on, and had a car accident. So there was the physical whiplash, there was the physical injury, but it was almost like that was the catalyst for my whole body and brain going, we're not in a good place. Right now, we're not in a good place, and there's something we need to do to address this. Yeah. And at that point, it was the first time that I saw a couple of different forms of therapy around talking about my feelings around the death of my brother.
Yeah.
Realizing that had been such a monumental event in my life. And I was only two. Yeah. When it happened, and I think there's a really big assumption, isn't that, like she's too young to know what that was, no, it absolutely shaped everything from that point on. I lived through that experience, and so it played a part. It coloured the lens through which I saw the world.
Yeah,
because I knew that had happened, and I'd been through that experience with my parents.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, absolutely, if anyone thinks that as a two-year-old you're not gonna get it, you go think about the fact that you would then have been a 2 year old in a house with two parents that have lost a son, and that has got to impact day to day. And whether you understand the words you're hearing, you know, is one question, but you feel the difference, the energy in the home, you know, what they were individually going through and as a pair, while still trying to care for a 2 year old. I mean, I can't even imagine. I can't even imagine.
Yeah, my mum actually engaged with EFT to process
mm-hmm.
some of that emotion, and it was so powerful for her. There was a real shift for her. There'd never been pictures of Warren anywhere up in the house. I think it was just too painful. So they got a box, they got the albums, they got everything. And I'd got a picture that I kept with me of him. And it, when she'd gone through her EFT, one of the things that had been suggested to her was getting a picture out, having a picture out. I started to engage with some therapy around that.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of toe in the water. I think I had a really, my expectation versus reality didn't match. I'd hoped that I could go and have this course of sessions and something would shift, something would be so different. I'd seen this shift for my mum, and I just wanted it to be that simple. And I'm sure it wasn't simple for her, but what I was seeing from an outside perspective,
yeah,
wanted it to be that easier. And it wasn't. So that journey for me continued for a number of years. And actually, I did more to address it head on with my fourth episode.
Yeah.
That third. But yeah, the wedding, that was one of the happiest things in my life, but it triggered a whole lot of questions that I didn't quite know how to answer or what to do with. And at that point, I was prescribed fluoxetine. Weirdest experience of medication of my life. I felt like I spent 6 months just numb.
Yeah.
Numb to everything. I was going through the motions of life, but with nothing. I think I've always been a person that experiences extremes. Like, I'm loud and I'm full of big gestures, and that's just a part of who I am. And all of a sudden, I was going through my day-to-day life just not feeling anything.
Yeah.
And there's some, I'd realised in this episode, there's some pain in feeling extremes.
Yeah.
But I also realised it's how I know I'm alive. It's how I know I'm alive, and it's where I do my best learning through having those emotions, having those experiences, and being able to go, oh, what does that tell me?
Yeah.
What do I know from that now that maybe I didn't before? Where can I get curious? Where can I explore? And so to have this period where I didn't feel to go through a my own wedding, just kind of feeling a bit numb.
Yeah.
I went, medication's not for me.
Yeah.
And it hadn't been with me. I'd used it for a period with my previous episodes, probably sort of 18 months, 2 years, and then weaned off, been okay. This one, I was like, no, this is not for me. This is not where I want to live. This is not how life should be lived. This isn't living.
Yeah, yeah. Because without the lows, and that's the thing, isn't it? And it's quite common. And I, you know, I spoke in my episode, my ex-husband managed depression and still does. And over the years, he's had a number of different medications. And I remember him talking about one that just meant he felt nothing. And so whilst there were moments where that felt better than the deep lows, what it took away was any ability to feel joy or feel elation. And so it's like flatlining, yep. Right? And going, so you don't feel any way about anything. And he talked about that a lot. And that's got to be a really difficult position to be in, because we take for granted the kind of the flurries of excitement. And yes, you don't want the deep lows, but to lose those, you know, punctuations of great stuff and fun and happiness and joy and hilarity and must be incredibly difficult.
Too great a price to pay.
Yeah.
It was the first time I was able to put into words what that process looked like for me. And I was able to explain that for me, what that medication did was give me the room, the space to get back on my feet.
Yeah.
It gave me the will. Like what you're saying, that wasn't living. And so actually, so I had to pick myself up, dust myself down, and figure out a way to get back to me. And so the gift it got, because there has to be a gift in all of it, doesn't there? The gift in it was just to have a break from the low to figure out how to put myself back the right way up. I was really determined that had to be time limited, and that time limited could not be as it had been for me in the past. It needed to be. I needed to take control of that. Needed to actively get myself into a different headspace with that. And so my last episode, again, a combination of things. I know looking back, there's never just one thing. It's always been down to a culmination in personal and work. And there's not a distinction. Like, there's this whole debate, isn't there? People say, when somebody says to you, what do you, who are you? What do you do? We automatically talk about our job. And is that who we are? We're so much more than that. But I've always been somebody that the work I do is so important to me. Like, that's my baby. That's what I birth into the world. The work that I do matters that much to me, that I don't want them to be separated. I want to get up and spend every day doing things that I love, and my work is a part of that. A part of that. I'd passed a significant birthday, what would have been my brother's 40th birthday. The bit of a mind fuck to go, like, 40, what would that have looked like? What would that life have looked like? But I was also in quite a toxic work environment. I'd gone through a couple of phases of working really hard, getting great results. That's wonderful. I go, okay, so what more can I do? How can I learn? How can I do more? And so I'd take on more and do more. And then I'd go, oh, this is really good. Can I have some acknowledgement, some recognition for that, whether that's in my job title, whether that's in my job description, whether that's in my pay, like whatever. And once again, hitting that wall of, oh, no, 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 no.
Yes.
No. And so a lot of things culminated. And I saw it coming. I saw it coming. And so took a sabbatical.
Yeah.
And that was really interesting. So wonderful that the place that I worked had this option.
Yeah.
How ridiculous that knowing I was really unwell, knowing that I was heading for burnout, I didn't feel I could go sick. I didn't think that I could admit to that. I felt like to admit to it would mean that I definitely didn't get those things that I was fighting really hard for.
Yeah.
And at the time, I didn't even realise that until when I went, there were a couple of things just before I went off. The most senior HR person said to me, "Oh, you're taking a sabbatical? Like, aren't you really lucky to be able to do that?" And I went, "I'm not lucky. Like, my life depends on it."
Yeah.
And that isn't too dramatic a statement.
Yeah.
That's genuinely where I'm at. And so I'd pulled back from a couple of the projects that I was working on that were supporting other departments and other people, definitely making them look good, definitely delivering on promises that they'd made.
Yeah.
Took that step back, knowing that I needed to do that for me. When I went back into the workplace at the end of that and looked to pick up those conversations, brick wall.
Yeah.
Brick wall. And actually, not just a brick wall, but we are now going to put you back in your place.
Mm.
This is what your job description says. This is what your job title says. And this is where you will stay. And we are going to make sure you know very clearly that you've already stepped a mark there. And that really took its toll. That combination of feeling like I was fighting the whole world externally whilst having this whole internal fight within me was just overwhelming. And I went back to the GP. I'm very, very adamant. I'm not doing medication again. I'm not taking the road. I'm not having you strip away any moments I might feel of joy. I've been here. This isn't my first time at the rodeo. I will find my way through. But I want counselling. I want to talk to somebody about the internal stuff.
Yes.
Let me have some help and some support with that.
Yeah.
And actually, if I can have some help and support with that, I know I have the resolve within me.
Yeah.
That I can then deal with.
Yeah. It's really it's so interesting because we talk in business, businesses talk a lot about root cause analysis. But when it comes to, you know, ourselves and self-care, we typically look for almost the Band-Aid. It's like we treat the symptom, but we don't treat the cause. And I'm with you. And it was, you know, therapy was the game changer. Because I think otherwise you're just waiting for the next episode, right? Because if you're not addressing the causality, then the reality is it's no shit, Sherlock. It's going to show itself again. And I think it's what also really interested me in what you just said was the business response. And I wonder... we had similar backgrounds. You carve out a career and sort of become known for being the fixer, the troubleshooter, the person who's super resilient and can go and tackle stuff that others can't. And it almost, and I want you to correct me if my kind of assessment of what you said, almost felt like, but the minute you, it didn't look like you were that person anymore, the restrictions came, and then it's like, oh right, so you're not the resilient Donna we thought you were, and so now you don't have as many opportunities because you've sort of created this you know, this persona. And it's not that it's a fabrication. I share that in terms of my own experience. You can be that person that can take on challenges that perhaps other people don't want to steer into, and feel you meet your purpose through achieving outcomes in more challenging circumstances. But that doesn't mean that you also don't have times, days, or conditions or situations where, you know, it all becomes too much. And it almost, as you played it back, so felt like they went, yeah, well, you're not as good as we thought you were, so now you're back, we're going to put you in that box.
I think it's interesting. I think there's a couple of angles we can only see the world through our own lens, can't
yes.
we? So I think on the one hand, yes, that definitely plays out. You pulled back from that. You made that decision. But actually within that, I was back to poking the bear.
Yeah.
I was back to holding up that mirror to say, hold on a minute. There's this and there's this and there's this. And now all of a sudden you're telling me that that's not the case. That's not how it played out. Like you are gaslighting me in the very definition of the word gaslighting.
Yeah.
And so I came to this realization both internally and externally. So at the point in my counselling journey and with my work situation, this moment of real stark reality, only person I can control is me. Only person I can do anything about, no matter how loud I shout, no matter how hard I stamp my feet, no matter how many tears I cry, the only person I have any control over is me. So what am I going to do? What am I going to do to put myself in a place where I feel I'm being true to myself? Like, I can't change this environment. I can't change the perceptions of the stakeholders. I can't change the piss poor practices that are playing out. As much as I'd love to, like, I've always been the champion of the underdog. And when something needs saying, I've got to fight that fight. And then I have that moment of going, hold on a minute, who are you doing this for? And where's that leaving you? And that was almost the ultimate.
Mm-hmm.
Donna minute, Donna.
Yeah.
What are you doing to yourself? Is this working for you? What can you do? What will you do? What change is that going to make?
What did you do?
So that was the shifting point. I called time on my counselling. It felt right. It felt like it had done what it needed to do. It was earlier than planned. It was earlier than the planned number of sessions. But actually that final conversation with the counsellor, just going, I just realised, like, this is on and with me. This is my journey. This is a part of who I am. There is nothing I can say, do, take, feel that's going to remove that from me. It's a part of who I am. And actually, it's about making peace with that and being able to see it holistically for not only where those moments where I question and I feel down and overwhelmed, but all of the flip side of that, all of the amazing things that it's helped to make me who I am. And in the work situation, I ultimately left. I left and went solo. And it's funny, isn't it? Again, I feel like I keep saying this, hindsight is 2020 vision. I look back now almost a year into my self-employment journey, and I laugh to myself going, Donna, you were never any good at having a boss. Like, it comes back to that whole rebelling against the authority figure. Like, just make that you. just make that you, and then the only person you are ever fighting with is you, and you know there's no point fighting with you. You make friends with that, and you find your best way through. So
it was the catalyst to a huge decision in that sense to go solo. And so when you look back at that, kind of, it feels like, you know, out of some of those really difficult situations has come something amazing. Okay. So it's like, you know, when people talk about, like I'm one of those individuals who really doesn't live life with a lot of regret. Because whilst I absolutely could pinpoint numerous situations and things that have happened in my life that were unpleasant and go, yeah, that wasn't nice to be in, that wasn't nice to feel, that wasn't nice to be at the effect of, whatever it might be, I look and go, but each of them led me to a new place. And I'm thankful for that. And so it's almost like you can't have the good without some of the trials and tribulations, or I can't envisage what a life would be like if it just everything just landed in your lap and, you know, played out exactly.
The good. Yeah. So good feels nice.
Yeah.
But comfort makes us complacent.
Mm-hmm.
The learning, the growth happens in those moments where mm-hmm. we're comfortable, where we make mistakes, where we question everything. Mm-hmm. Like those are the pivotal points.
Yeah.
Those are the moments where you figure out who you really are. If for that moment, because none of it's static, is it? We're dynamic as human beings. It's forever changing. So yeah. If I look at those four episodes that have punctuated each decade of my life so far, each of them was at a point where I can look back and go, you'd through circumstances, made choices, because you'd made choices that put you in a place that wasn't you, that wasn't you living your full potential and all that life is supposed to be about. And I'm a big advocate for that. It's what life is, what we create for ourselves. Life is owning the choices that you make, being open to being wrong, being open to finding a dark corner and having a word with yourself every now and again to go, look, what are you playing at? If this isn't right, forget them or her or him or that policy or that. What are you going to do? Because you're the person you go to bed with at the end of the night. You're the person you get up with in the morning. What do you need, and what are you going to do about it?
Yeah, so I love that. I think it's interesting as well, because I have an observation. I typically give myself too much to do. And I think that that's often the case when you find joy in overcoming challenges, right? So that it's back to the sort of troubleshooting early doors. You find joy and success through tackling the stuff other people don't want to, and the recognition and reward and all the things that come with that almost become, certainly for me, became almost addictive. So you're then seeking out, I found myself literally looking and going, what's the shit gig no other person wants to do? I'm going, I'll do it. Because it's that sort of, I've got to now seek, and I've got to do more, because now I'm known for doing that. I'm constantly pushing the boundaries. But I look and then go, I apply that in life, because it's interesting to me. One of your episodes, your third episode you talked about was in the lead up to your wedding. And I guess for external observers, they look and go, but a wedding is an amazing and exciting thing. But you go, I think these things are not ever, they're never linear. So you're going, a wedding is an exciting thing, but it's also a high pressure thing, right? A lot to do. And as you said before, life is cumulative. So it's the wedding on top of everything else that's going on. So often for me, I see these things as they're being almost a straw that breaks the camel's back. And so it's not the wedding, it that that would, if you were doing the job you're doing now, working for yourself, that would have felt very different. So it's not necessarily even the incidents or the activities, it's the sort of the combination of those things. Does that sort of make sense?
It does. This the idea of doing more definitely resonates. And I think as I heard you talk that through, I made two notes of things to come back to, because I'm getting so caught up in the thinking, like, that's a good, I want to make that, I want to say that.
Yeah.
Two things. Doing more was always a way of pushing the feelings aside. If you're busy, if you're doing,
distraction, 100%. Yeah.
So I think there's a recognition of that. So I can, with each episode, I can see myself ramping up, do more, as a way to, it might not happen then. No, it will. And it, you're just accelerating. Actually, you're just accelerating getting to that. I think within all of it, it comes back to a need. We need to have a balance between doing and being. I think that's the lesson I'm coming round to.
Yeah.
Actually, it's the balance of doing and being. Doing will get you so far.
Yeah.
But in those moments of quiet, in those moments of silence, in those moments of just being with yourself.
Yeah.
How does that feel?
Yeah. Or
doing in the world,
but
you're still going to have those moments on your own with just yourself. And until you learn to get comfortable with that place, it's a mechanism that serves its purpose, isn't it?
Yeah.
Until eventually, like the glue on the glasses, like if you do a Jack Duckworth and put sellotape around your glasses, it will hold for so long, but eventually that's going to go.
Yeah.
It's the same, isn't it? And I do wonder if there's something in nature that prepares you for this. Like, so a friend said to me, oh, how are you getting on with your self-employment journey? Oh, it's amazing. I should have done it years ago. I couldn't have done it years ago. No. I didn't know then what I know now.
Yeah.
But is there also something about reaching middle age, reaching 40s, with all of the changes that come with that?
Yeah.
Put you in a very different place. So my grandma is one of the most positive role models in my life. She means the world to me. And a couple of years ago, so when my dad retired, my parents moved down to Cornwall and they took my grandma with them, living the dream, like seriously living the dream. And I remember talking to my grandma and saying, how's it all going? How are you feeling? Like, how are you settling in? Yeah, it's fine. And there'd been a spell of a couple of people that she knew dying.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, it's fine, Donna, like, that's just what happens, isn't it? As you get older, you just get ready to die. What? Like, come on, please don't talk like that. That's crazy. And she's like, no, I don't. There's no judgment in there. It's just a fact of life, Donna, that as you get older, something within your makeup prepares you for where you're at in life. And where I'm at in life is that I'm going to die, and it's not that far away.
God.
So immediately my reaction is, you can't, please don't talk like that. Like, I can't, please don't. I can't think about that. Actually, when you step back and you reflect on it, you go, fuck yeah.
Mm.
That is exactly the journey we take. We go through early 20s, 30s. I'm out in the world. I'm proving myself. This is the prime of my life. I'm achieving everything that I can. I'm letting the world know I'm here. You move into your 40s and perimenopause hits, and all of a sudden you're dealing with hot flushes and emotions that are more of a roller coaster than they've ever been. You just go, yeah, life's just, something in nature is preparing me for that next part of my journey. And at this part of my journey, it's about being able to harness all of that experience and all of that learning to absolutely make the most of the time that I'm at now.
So talk to me about your experiences in terms of your sort of episodes. How do you now manage that? So with the experiences that you've had, how, you know, day to day, what do you do? Because you now have the opportunity, you work for yourself, so you have much greater control, let's say, around what you do and don't do. What are you looking out for? How do you make sure that you focus enough on yourself and checking in?
So I think first off, there's a real acceptance that it will always be a learning curve. So yeah. I'm only just coming to the end of my first year in this new part of my journey.
Yeah.
I've gone and I've made those same mistakes. Do more, do more, do more. No. This is right. I think I notice the warning signs quicker. I think I'm more tuned into myself. So big one for me, getting comfortable with sitting quietly. I'm not naturally a quiet person. Time in nature is really valuable to me. So whether that is sitting in my garden, whether that's taking a walk around a field, whether that is going and spending time by the sea, just stopping in greater than me. I'm a tiny little speck and need to remember that it's when it gets overwhelming, it's because I've become too insular in my own importance.
Yeah.
Stop and take a step back and engage those senses, whether it's looking or smelling or tasting or feeling. I've really connected to my senses a lot better. So savouring a beautiful cup of herbal tea, like I've got my tea wall with all my different flavours of tea, and I'll stand and ponder over, what do I fancy right now? What's the experience that I want?
Yeah.
Or going out and taking photos of the different flowers in my garden. Just something that makes me stop and notice.
Yeah.
Stop and really see all of the things that in day to day just is by. So that's really big. I think taking care of my body a little bit better. So moving, water, sleep's always been super important to me. That's one of my first signs that things are not good. When sleep goes, there's a problem, and at some point I know that has to be caught up on. That has to be indulged. I guess with all of it, tuning in. Used to just push down, like, if you don't notice, it's not really there, is it? And actually I don't do that now. I stop and I tune in and go, oh, something feels off. Something's not wrong. Getting curious about that, so welcoming it instead of pushing it away.
Also, I think it's being more curious in terms of seeking to understand what it is. I think sometimes it's really easy when things don't feel good to leap to the assumption that it's something that's happening right here, right now. So it could be, you know, a particular meeting or conversation that hasn't gone well, and it's really easy to go, I feel shit, because I just had that conversation. But often that's not it. As I said, there's often the straw that breaks the camel's back, or, you know, there are other things, and the feelings are cumulative. So it's sort of unpicking that and unpacking actually what else is there. So yesterday I felt pretty good, but I wasn't great. So before this happened, there was already some stuff going on. And I think you're right. Tuning in is the big, you know, the big thing, not jumping to those conclusions. So what's the plan now? So you're a year in, loving it.
Yes. to so I guess this is one of the biggest shifts. Not striving. Just enjoying what I'm doing here and now. I think there's inevitably that fear, isn't there? Security, stability, kind of pay my mortgage. Yeah. Like those are very real thoughts and feelings. Having somebody to talk those through, saying them out loud, can be really useful, really powerful. And so I guess what I'm trying to do is take it as it comes, learn to be more in flow.
Yeah.
Striving served its purpose.
Yeah.
And it no longer serves me well. It's no longer where I want to spend my time. That doesn't mean there aren't things that I want to achieve. Yeah. But I want to enjoy and savor each thing along the way. I've crafted an experience that on the whole makes me really happy. I get to do meaningful work that I am so, so passionate about. I get to learn every day. I get to connect with different people from different walks of life and support them to do their own learning. Past that and paying my mortgage, I just want to enjoy it.
It's the simplification, isn't it? And you kind of go, because typically we'd look and kind of go, we've got this long list of, you know, what we're worrying about and this long list of things that we want to achieve. And I'm so with you on the, I know when we started the business, so much of my time was almost fast forward 3, 4 or 5 years. And going, hang on, there's some amazing stuff happening now, in this moment, today, this week, and just be present. So I think I definitely feel like my learning over the last few years is just to slow down and kind of go, otherwise there's almost a wishing your life away. Because when people do like a 5-year plan,
yeah,
it's almost then saying in 5 years' time, I'm not saying you shouldn't do a 5-year plan, but my friend has a saying, I've mentioned this on a couple of interviews I've done, she says, have a plan, but don't fall in love with the plan, right? Yeah, yeah. Because it's almost then saying, right, so that's my plan in 5 years, it's utopian, and if I'm not there, then I've failed, right? And you're going, no, because that means you might get there and go, well, I've fallen short on one of the things I set for myself, but I've achieved 37. But yeah, we focus on the one bit we haven't achieved.
It's this idea of I will be happy when. Fuck that. Be happy now.
Yeah, 100%.
And I I've even done it in, I'm really grateful that I feel like I've tapped into some shortcuts on learning faster. Having gone through all of these challenges, I feel like I've tapped into some of the shortcuts. And when I decided that I was going to make this leap, before I'd actually left employment, I started to build my networks, engage in some training, bit of mentoring, and that sort of saw me through that initial transition period. But I noticed really, really quickly that I felt really uncomfortable when I was looking sidewards. Looking sidewards is not helpful. Oh, they're doing that. They're aiming for that. They've achieved that amount of money. They've got X amount of customers. That's them. Let them do them.
Yeah.
Like,
well, and sometimes have they? I think that's the other thing. You know, you look at the rise of sort of social media, and there's a bit of a backlash at the moment on LinkedIn, where people are saying individuals are rocking up and saying, look how brilliantly I'm doing. And lots of people that are kind of in it, you know, in the grind, you know, trying to build their, you know, their businesses and so on, look and go, why haven't I achieved what they've achieved? Well, one, we don't really know what they've achieved anyway, right? And like, so
what are you getting out of putting that out there? So what purpose does it serve? One of my favorite questions. What purpose does it serve? Why do you feel the need to tell everybody that? What purpose does it serve?
I think if it comes with sort of tangible, you know, guidance and you're sharing something that says, look, I, you know, you can go on this journey and avoid some of the mistakes I made, because I'll share some of my mistakes and therefore you perhaps don't have to learn the hard way as I did, right? Then I go, cool. But if it's just look at how amazing I am, then yeah, to your point, brilliant. You know,
and quite frankly, if you want to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and hustle for 17 hours of your day, you go do that. You go do that.
Yeah.
That's not what makes me happy.
Yeah.
That's not where I need to. That's not where I need to be or live my life. I'm also, you got me thinking there, what have I posted about in the last year? Because there's this whole thing, isn't there, when you, particularly when you go self-employed, you've got to build. Like, if people don't know you're there,
yes,
you're not going to have any customers, there isn't going to be any business. So you, marketing is one of those things that you have to get comfortable with doing. Yeah. Where have I put out there anything like that around, look at me, look at what I'm doing? I don't think so. I'd feel really uncomfortable actually to look back and see that that's what I've done. But what I have done, and this would definitely be one of my strategies, gratitude. I'm really grateful for the opportunities that have come my way, for the people that have chosen to work with me, for the things I've learned from the people that I've been able to work with, for knowing that in some small way I got to make a difference. So I definitely have put some stuff out there that's been about me taking a moment of gratitude and appreciation. Yeah. And I know that when I do that, it's usually because I've just come out of a moment of feeling something.
Yeah.
And it's really important for me and my well-being to go, hold on, what's the other side of the coin right now? Where's the good? Where's the silver lining? Because there's always one. There's however shit. We're only able to get up and dust ourselves down by finding that thing we can look to, hold on to in our hearts. So, but yeah, you know, I made 7-figure sum hustling this. And okay, crack on.
Yeah, good for you. So, we've reached that point. The final question, as always, soundtrack to your life.
So it's funny. This is, having listened to several episodes, I knew it was coming. There was a song that came to mind straight away. And then I went into a whole spiral of, there are so many songs. Like,
yeah.
Sometimes it's the music, sometimes it's the lyrics, but songs like make the world better, don't they? And they tell stories all the way through. I come back to the first one that popped into my head, and that is Bon Jovi's It's My Life. And it's a given. So Bon Jovi's album Crossroads was the soundtrack to my teenage years. My best friend still, like, put it on in the car and rock out. But that one, It's My Life. It's now or never. I ain't gonna live forever. I just want to live while I'm alive, and I do. I spent years thinking I had to apologize for being the person that I am, for living at the extremes of feelings and expression, and I don't. It's my life, and I'm gonna live my way, and I'm gonna love it as I do that.
Oh, I love that. I love that. And that's a first, because I think there are, if people have listened to previous episodes, they tend to try and avoid something that's come up before. But there are lots of songs that, you know, would have a title that would lend itself. But yeah, so that's a first for Bon Jovi. So so thank you.
Cheesy 80s rock girl. What can I say?
Be unapologetic, right?
Absolutely. At least I didn't break into song.
That's true. Although, yeah, you may be able to sing beautifully, who knows? But no. Well, I'd just like to say thank you. It's been amazing, and your, you know, candor has been fantastic. And I really appreciate that. Thank you.
It's been lovely. I've really enjoyed chatting to you again. It's it just flows, doesn't it? You make it so easy just to have a good old chat. So thank you. I really appreciate that.
No, you're welcome.